Hey, let's have an AA meeting. Okay, my name's Jay, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the Nava Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you to all the readers. Got one last reading. We'll make it real quick, and we'll get to our featured speaker. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Well, we've been looking forward to having Bonnie here for a few weeks now. My sponsor, Tim Moore, ran into Bonnie at Toco, and we were already in process. It was ordained. Please welcome Bonnie.
I have brought paper and pen just in case I get bored by the speaker and want to draw some pictures. I'll be okay. I'm Bonnie. I'm an alcoholic. A trip. This is really a trip. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to start there. And I have, as of today, in that little phone that tells you how long you've been sober, I have been sober 12,203 days. And ladies, that's 400 months that I have not had a drink. And that comes to 33.4 years without any alcohol. Don't you think the drugs are working pretty well? Can you tell? I was 22 when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was really, really one of those sick and tired human beings. I had been seeking relief for living for about 11 years by daily drinking, drugging, whatever I could find, and everything I ever wanted regarding not drinking, I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous, and much of that has happened in this room. I've really grown up a lot at NABA. I want to say that I find it odd that I'm getting accolades for not doing something. You know? I mean, it's really great organization. I don't have to do anything. I get chips and medals and medallions for just not drinking alcohol. And, you know, I've said in meetings often that this is the first place I've ever been where I've really gotten exactly what I wanted. You know, when the tradition that says that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I mean, I just have to want this. I don't have to know how to do it. I don't even have to do it well. I just have to want this. And I can say that I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that not drinking for me, for this alcoholic, is really miraculous. I wanted to not drink, and I kept drinking. I had all kinds of things that I tried to not drink. I'm sure that, you know, that list in the Big Book where they list, we drank less, more on Thursdays, on Sundays, never before five. I mean, I did all of that. And because I was born into a family of alcoholics, I had an unending supply of alcohol. In fact, my father did ultimately get sober, and he's dead now, but we talked once about the quantities of alcohol that I would take from his bar. And he said, you know, I couldn't ever quite figure it out, because my older brother and I just figured out that if we just took whole fifths of liquor, that he would think maybe he hadn't bought enough, you know? So instead of what I started doing, which was taking a baby bottle that I'd stolen from Doc White's drugstore and filling it with scotch and then adding water or whatever to their... I got really wise. I figured out I could just take the whole bottle and everything would be okay. So we had a laugh about that. So I'm supposed to talk without cursing about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'm going to try my best. Although when I heard that suggestion, my very first thought, you can imagine. You can imagine what I first thought about that. But I was thinking about what happened. You know, a whole lot of things happened that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And a huge one was a woman that I met when I was about, I guess about 20 years old. And as I wrote her name down today, I realized that her name is the same as my dog. I just realized that I named my dog this woman's name. But she said to me one day at work, I was working in a jazz nightclub at the time. I was married to a man I'd met at the Bahamas for a four-day vacation. I was addicted to drugs, dealing drugs to make a living, and or actually to get more drugs, you know how that works. And of course, I was underage, but I was working a bar where it was perfectly fine for me to drink everything I wanted. I think, I mean, an unending supply. And she came, she said to me once that she had gone jogging down by the river, and that she had seen these people, and she realized that she was not afraid. So this woman described an experience where she said, "I was not afraid." And I was speechless. I thought, how could anyone do anything and say that they were not afraid? Because at that point in my life, I was petrified. I was petrified. I only got out of my house to go to work, to get more money, so that I could do more drugs, so that I could stay in my bedroom, so that I could go to work. I mean, I was afraid of everything. I didn't go to movies. I mean, if it wasn't drugs and alcohol or work, I didn't do it. And I asked her, of course, how that happened. How could she possibly have this experience? And she told me that these people she had met, and she goes for the weekend, and they teach meditation and do all this stuff. And I thought, well, I got to do that. Well, for about a year, I went where this woman went once a month for the weekend. And that was the first time in my life that I had gone for 72 hours without alcohol and drugs. Now, I'm sitting in the front row of this lecture hall, weeping, right? I didn't have any idea I was going through drug withdrawal. I mean, the guy said we could drink coffee and smoke cigarettes, but we couldn't do anything else. I thought, okay, I can do that. But I had the very first experience of getting back to my house, and I wasn't under the influence for that moment. And of course, before the sun went down, I was. But I remember thinking, wow, this is different. Not drinking, not drugging is different. Well, after about a year of that, because I started trying not to drink, which I had done before. But when I tried not to drink before, not knowing about alcoholism, I just smoked pot every single day, and as soon as somebody handed me a drink and I drank it, I was off to the races. But this time, I thought, what if I just didn't drink, didn't drug, what would that be? And you know, I couldn't stop. I could not stop. I would go places and be with people, I mean, try to be with those normal folks, you know, and I couldn't. And the day of my very last drink was a Sunday, and I had gone to work, and I had a friend who I just thought the world of this girl, and so we were going to go bowling. I thought, if we go bowling, then I won't drink tonight, and I can just do something after work. So she was going to meet me at the bowling alley, so I went to the bowling alley. Well, do you know that they have a bar at the bowling alley? I didn't know they had a bar at bowling alley because, of course, I was always drunk or stoned when I got there. But I found out that the bar, in order to go to the restroom, I had to go through the bar. So I walked past the bar, I went to the restroom, I came out of the bar, bathroom, and went straight to the bar. Asked him for a drink that he didn't have because it was 4 o'clock in the morning. Can't make that at this hour. And I said, oh, then just give me a shot. So I'm drinking shots of alcohol in a plastic cup with dried up lime. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is the pit. I have just gone to the bottom. I am drinking liquor out of a plastic cup at a bowling alley. I can't go any lower. Well, I didn't black out, which was sort of my habit. That night I didn't black out. I had multiple drinks. I made it to the night, drove home, and kind of recounted this story to my then husband. And he just said, you know, I've had enough of this. I've just had enough. And I said, don't go. Just don't go tonight. I'm going to do something about my drinking. Well, I had no idea. I'd never been to an AA meeting. I mean, this is 1980, okay? So they didn't have it on prime time in 1980. I mean, I don't know that I'd ever really talked about Alcoholics Anonymous before. And so I had no idea what I was going to do. But he stayed the night. He didn't leave. And when I came to AA, I found out later that the bottom is, you know, often described as when you're about to lose something you think you can't live without. And this guy had put up with more shite than I could possibly imagine. I would go away for days, and he, you know, I would just disappear. You know how it goes. You follow the train to wherever, you know. And he was always there. Now, granted, this was the guy that I met in the Bahamas on a 4-day vacation. So he thought I was like a princess because I had a television that was this big and I had a car. Granted, it was illegal, right? Had no tags, couldn't pass inspection, and you couldn't even get into the driver's side. You had to go through the side, you know, passenger side to get into the car. But he thought because of all of those things that, I mean, I was worth waiting for, you know, I guess. And so he didn't leave. He didn't leave. And I didn't know what else to do if I wasn't going to drink alcohol than to call work and say, I can't come to work. And then I went to 7-Onda and I bought a 5-gallon jug of Crystal Springs water, put that in the back seat of my car, and I left Atlanta determined not to eat, because if I didn't eat, then I wouldn't drink. So I was going to fast until I figured this thing out. Oh, God. Oh, my God. Anyway, I had heard that my mother was somewhere in the area. She had taken off several years prior to that. And she was following her dream in a little Winnebago thing with some guy half her age. And but I heard that she was sort of in the area. And I went to go find her. You know how it is? You think, oh, Mom's going to help me out here. And when I got there, I mean, I was a mess, she was a mess, and, you know, I'm trying to tell her, oh, my woes, and she goes, well, she didn't question my not eating, by the way, but she said, well, here, why don't you read this? And she handed me the 12 in 12. She said, you know, we travel a lot, and we don't have a lot of space for things, but I do have a few books, and this one you might want to read. So I read through the 6th step. And immediately I said, I got to find these people. Who are these people? This is me. And she, of course, because she's my mother, you'd have to meet her. But anyway, she wasn't going to meetings. She just was reading this book. And I don't know that she was clean and sober, but she was just reading this book. And but I had heard that my father was doing something about not drinking. And he lived in North Carolina. So I decided I would go to North Carolina and find him. Well, you'd have to know my dad to know that he was super mellow, unless you poured alcohol and drugs in him, and then he was a maniacal asshole. But without all of that, he was a really nice guy. And so I showed up. It was a Saturday, so this is from Sunday. So all week I'm not eating, right? And I get to my dad's in North Carolina, and he didn't even ask me why I was there. He was just like, okay, well, Bonnie showed up, which I probably had done once or twice in my, because I didn't see him for 5 years and all that craziness. But anyway, I said, well, do you still go to those places on Saturday? And he goes, well, yeah. I said, well, I think I want to go. So at this point, I have on a white dress. Okay, I'm 22 years old. I have on the white dress that I graduated from high school in. And it has tar stains all over it from the beach, if you know what I mean. So I'm looking to kill, you know. And so we go to this meeting, and the guy at the podium, who happened to be his sponsor, was a guy who told a story about his crazy drunk life of seeing chickens crossing I-95 in Virginia and get pissed off at his wife and piling up all of the furniture in the house and living room and then watching it burn. And I'm like, wow, I get that. I mean, I get that. I understand. I mean, that makes total sense, you know? And so afterwards, I mean, I'll never forget where I was sitting when they started offering the white chips. And I went and got a white chip. And this must be unedited, I'm so sorry. But my first thought when I picked up a white chip was, oh, shit, what have I done? I was, oh, my God, what have I done? Who are these people? What have I done? And, you know, I didn't know what I had done. I didn't know. I know that I was invited after that meeting to go to somebody's house to eat ice cream. And I drove my car to this place and sat on the street, and I could see the people in the house, you know. And I knew that they were eating ice cream in there. And I thought, what do? I don't like ice cream, you know. What are these people doing eating ice cream? I mean, I was just, when I think about it now, it was more fear. I was just petrified. So I didn't drink, came back to Atlanta. I had found a nice dress in the dryer that I thought would be more appropriate for the AA meeting that I went to. So I took that dress that I found in the dryer, and I went to the meeting down at Virginia Highland area. And I went in there, and there was a guy there named Ike. He was sitting by the door, and somebody said, Ike, you know, he's been sober 17 years. And I'm thinking, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. He doesn't drink like I do. You know, there's no way that somebody can be sober. But then this other guy over here that's coming down off drugs, and he's got like 3 or 4 days, that's the guy that I looked at the whole meeting. And, of course, he and I talked afterwards. But I'll never forget being so amazed that what was offered here was something I could not imagine. And that meeting, they handed out pieces of paper that had the slogans, the things that we tell each other in those one little bits. Excuse me. And I listened to all of that. People would sort of bring up other things. I remember there was this piece of paper, and they handed the paper around. And I was like, I really thought that not drinking was like a secret formula, like some secret handshake. I mean, I remember sitting in this room for a long time, not knowing what it was. And so I had these slogans in my mind, and then I'm trying to figure out how to use them. Because remember, my underlying problem was that I was afraid. And there were lots of reasons for that. There were lots of reasons. And one was that I had this incredible older brother who used to beat the shit out of me. And I attribute my toughness to that guy today. And then we'd also moved around a lot. My parents had met in Decatur. It was one of those marriages that happened in the 50s, I think. But they got married then, started traveling corporate ladder. I was born in Fort Knox, Kentucky. And we moved around, I guess by the time I graduated from high school, I was adding it up. I changed schools 8 times. In 3 states before I was 17. And I had gone to private schools, public schools, co-ed schools, all women's schools. And in all of them, seemingly every single class, the first day of class, they would say, is anyone in here left-handed? And I would have to raise my hand. And I was the only left-handed person. So instantly, in all of these new schools, I felt different. And the worst was they would say, oh, yes, you're left-handed, you need a left-handed desk. And, you know, some of them, I'd never get a left-handed desk. So not only did they know that I needed a left-handed desk, they just wouldn't give it to me. So then I felt especially different. Left-handed. So by the time I found alcohol and drugs when I was about 10, 11 years old, I really needed some relief. And up till that point, I'd found a lot of relief in the Episcopal Church. We had been in different churches, but somewhere in Virginia, I was confirmed Episcopalian. And I just thought that was great. I really did. I found a lot of relief in that. But my parents' drinking was getting worse. The violence was getting worse. My older brother was going insane. My parents were not getting along with anybody. It was terrible. And one of the things that I had to ultimately take responsible for is that I never told anyone in school, no adult, no authority, I never told anybody what was going on in my house. And that's the only piece of this I've got to be responsible for my life that I'm going to take responsibility for, is because I could have spoken up, but I didn't. And so I took all of that to the Episcopal prayer book, and it just stopped working. So when I was about 10 or 11 years old, I just, with great ceremony, I remember the exact moment, I closed that book and I said, it's not here. And I started my beer can pyramid. And I just, you know, that was it. I was an isolated drinker at that age because, you know, my friends didn't drink the way I did. My friends didn't have a plastic baby bottle that they would squeeze scotch to the back of their throat so they could get drunk. It was socially inappropriate. I was ahead of the game, you know. And so I started medicating the depression and the fear and the anger, confusion, all of that. And I also had elected myself to be the one to stay awake all night long to stop the madness, you know, to keep people alive, because I was convinced that somebody was going to die if I didn't. So I bring all of that to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was in this room that I picked up my 6 months chip. My sponsor at the time describes it as slinking along the wall. It was this wall that was here. And she said, you just started slinking up the wall to pick up your chip. Because when I first got here, I couldn't have eye contact with somebody without a drink or drug. I mean, I couldn't do it. I would have these amazing paintings I was going to do on the floor, you know. I could not look at you without some anesthetic. And that's why I love discussion meetings. Because you're going to listen to me for 3 to 5 minutes no matter what. I don't have to look at you. You're not going to ask me any questions. There's no right answer. And being able to speak in a meeting was profound healing for me. Because the one thing my parents, well, my mother did it, she just figured out that, you know, the divide and conquer bit, it really works. You know, you feed the kids at 6, they put their dishes in the dishwasher at 6:30, and they go to their room. I mean, my brother and I and my sister had devised all kinds of sneaking around. You know, we often had nice houses, I have to say, with back stairways, you know, and we would hide and sneak and do anything we could to interact with each other. Because, you know, my drunk mother, who had been raised a single child, was determined that it was going to be a bad thing. You know, there might be a mutiny here if these kids start talking. So I was pretty petrified. I was, as a young person, decided that really what I wanted to do was draw pictures, and that was not cool. So, you know, I was this weirdo kid who didn't say anything, and what's wrong with you? You write your name upside down and backwards. I mean, that Leonardo stuff where he wrote all of his stuff backwards, I could read that, you know? I don't read Italian, but it made sense to me that somebody could write like that. So feeling ever so different at 22 years old, I show up here. And you all start saying things to me that are baffling. Like, the first drink is what gets me drunk. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Because I could drink more than you, and I could drive home, and I could talk my way out of a police, you know, interrogation, you know. How could that be that the first drink was going to get me drunk? So I tested it. So I didn't drink. But now, granted, I worked for 14 years of sobriety. I worked around alcohol in a jazz nightclub. And so I got off work one Sunday evening, and I decided that I was going to figure this first drink thing out. So I went down to a place that was down on Spring Street. It's not there now. And I went to the bar. And I sat there. And the bartender says, well, what do you want? How can I help? And I'm just looking at him. And I said, well, you know, I want my second drink. And he's like, really? And so I sat there. Finally, I decided to order a tab. You remember the tabs that they had? So I drink my tab, and I pay my check, and I leave. So I couldn't have my second drink unless I had the first drink. And I didn't want the first drink because you told me that was going to get me drunk. So the next Sunday, I did exactly the same thing again. And I realized that there is no second drink. And if I can't have the first one, I can't have the second one. And I finally believed it, that maybe you're right. Just maybe you're right. When I came to AA in August of 1980, I was living in a house that I had purchased, that I had gutted all of the rooms. And the house note was $175 a month, which was more than I could afford. I dealt drugs. Again, I'm married to this Bahamian guy. So we had to rent one of the rooms to a couple so they could give us some money so we could pay the rent. And again, I took all the walls down, but they had cats. So I had a dog, they had cats. So we put chicken wire up to make them a room that the cat couldn't leave. And, of course, nuptials were in the car in the street. And I'm living off my sister's child support because I had custody of my younger sister for 3 years. And that was my life when I came to AA. That was the house I was living in when I had my last drink. So when I came to AA and you told me that my life was unmanageable, you know, I didn't believe it. I had a job. I mean, how is my life unmanageable? And it took me months. I mean, that's the thing that's so wonderful. This is why I love Alcoholics Anonymous, is nobody got in my face about what I needed to work out for myself in order to stay sober. Nobody said, you can't do that. Everybody said, keep coming back. And everybody said, as long as I don't drink today, I'm a winner. Nobody told me that I couldn't work in a bar. Nobody told me that I couldn't go to a bar. Nobody told me that I shouldn't be dealing drugs. I mean, nobody said that there's this mark about sobriety. It was just like, you know, there's Bonnie again. So, my life is unmanageable, powerless over alcohol. And then I've got this God thing. And I've been thinking a lot about God because for different periods of my life in sobriety, there are times when I notice that I don't say the word God. I just don't say God. Hey, Deidre, I didn't know you were there. And when I got to the second step, of course, I thought that because I had been this ordained Episcopalian that I had this cool relationship with God. And I'd been to this meditation retreat And so the fact that I had to study this idea of where am I in relationship to God, I just didn't want to do it until I read the 12 and 12. I really love the 12 and 12 because in there I have these choices. I get to read about who am I in relationship with God. And I found myself to be the belligerent one, you know, which is also nice to know where I stand. That thing, you know, the big book where it says one characteristic that is common to so many of us is defiance. So I think that's spot on. I definitely think that's spot on. So then I get to, okay, so I'm kind of had a relationship with God and now I don't. So then how am I going to relate to God? And what am I going to do? This whole third step, whatever. Turning my life and will over to the care of God. Well, the care is what I had a hard time with because my parents my father, even when he died, didn't know how old I was. He'd always ask me, how old I was, when's your birthday, you know. And it got to be kind of a family joke. But, I mean, I just don't think that they... I think that children just sort of happened, you know? I don't think there was any grand design to that family unit. And so I don't think there was a lot of care. And when I came in here and that people are saying that I have to make certain decisions about this power, this whole power issue, and, like, make a decision... I kind of struggled with it until I did what the sponsor suggested, which was read the 12 and 12 twice a day for 2 weeks. And at 14 months of sobriety, not drinking, not drugging, everything changed. Because I found in there the statement that says, a period of sobriety followed by attendance at a few meetings is a fine thing indeed, but it's a far cry from permanent sobriety and a contented, useful life. Permanent. Permanent. So for the first time, I realized that I don't ever have to drink again. But then I'm left with this, what the fuck do I do sober? You know? Okay, so I'm not drinking anymore, but what does that mean? What do I do? What do I do? How do I go to a movie? How do I have a date? I was a year sober, and my assignment at a year sober was to go down to this two-for-one, buy-your-shirt thing that was over here on Peachtree at the time. And I had to go buy myself a new piece of clothing because most of my clothes had come out of dryers at public laundromats or at the used clothes store. So I didn't know what size clothes I wore. I didn't know what style I liked. And you know... My sponsor very lovingly said, why don't you just, you know, take $5 and go buy yourself something. And I remember standing there going, what, do I like this? One of them was this blue, really fluffy thing. And the other one was like this Hawaiian shirt, right? I mean, it's probably a man's shirt. I don't know. But I had those two shirts that I bought myself after I'd been clean and sober for years. I had really a lot to learn here. I had so much to learn. When I was a couple years sober, I came to a meeting every day here for about the first 2.5 years. And then a friend of mine called who wasn't in AA, and she said, what the hell are you doing? So you think you're hot stuff because you're not drinking. What are you going to do with your life? So I'm 23, 24 years old, and she dares me to go back to college, which, of course, I had stopped because you can't do that and live the life I was living. So I decided I was going to go back to school. And at that juncture, I had to face, how am I going to do that? How am I going to get out of the security of going to NABA, eating breakfast, going to work in the bar, going to NABA, eating breakfast, going to work at the bar, and go out to have to do something I want to do? Because in the inventory process, I found out some things about myself, some things that I really wanted to do, and finishing my college degree was one of them. And that's when I... talked to my sponsor about how do I do this? How do I do this? And she and I talked about meeting attendance. And in all seriousness, we kind of looked at, okay, when do I go insane? How long does it take for me to be batshit crazy? And it usually takes a few days. So we decided that I can go to college, but I should go to a meeting every third day, no matter what, whether I think I need to go or not. And that's when I started using the meeting attendance consciously as a treatment. Because before it was sort of like a habit and it felt good and, you know, it was a place to go. But suddenly I'm adding other things to my life. And a couple of days during that experience, I called them mental health days. I would come to NABA and I would be here all day long. I'd go to like 4 AA meetings. You know, I just would hide out here just before I was about to lose my mind. And I did. I finished my degree in about 2.5 years. And the kid that had been raised in these schools, you know, I had been told often that there was a discrepancy between my testing and my performance. And so when I went to school clean and sober, I decided to see what I could do when there wasn't a discrepancy between my testing and my performance. And I ended up graduating with honors, which was just like, I couldn't believe it. And I worked really, really hard because I discovered that if you smoke pot every day for 9 years religiously, you have a lot of short-term memory loss. So I had to work really hard in my art history classes because you have lots of memorization. So back to this thing of how am I going to stay sober without a drink? And I live a lot by the slogans. And the biggest one is get up, clean up, show up. Because I wake up pretty mentally ill every day. And if it wasn't for caffeine and the hot... I mean, I have two double six-cup shot espresso makers that are ceremoniously on the stove. And that's why I make it at night before I go to sleep. And if I'm feeling literally insecure, I'll make the coffee at night so that it's there. All I have to do is microwave it. And so I wake up with this propensity to self-destruction and negativity and fear. And if I didn't have that voice that said, Bonnie, just get up, you know, make your bed, take a shower, get dressed, get ready for the day. And it takes 45 minutes or an hour before I can really start to see a positive event, you know. And one thing that I do with great regularity is I find the statement, God, please help me stay clean and sober today. Because it kind of gives me that purpose, you know. AA really has this purpose, that staying sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. I mean, I didn't have a purpose, a positive... What was that? I'm thinking of some movie character now. My positive purpose. Oh, it was a Steve Martin comedy. That's just what floated past my brain. But I didn't have a purpose until I came here to AA. So I'm waking up with this crazy disease, you know, and I've got the find a way to stay sober. The third step prayer, where it says, God, build with me and do with me. I mean, build with me. I mean, to me, that sends me to that thing of God, don't make no junk. Have you heard that one? Because I heard that a lot when I got sober. God, don't make no junk. Because I felt so bad about myself that I needed the reassurance that I was not an error. I mean, God, don't make no junk. I might not have had anybody say, Bonnie, you're wonderful. I'm so glad I gave birth to you. You're my favorite daughter. I think my mother told me she loved me when I was about 24. And so I didn't have that, but AA told me that. AA told me that God don't make no junk. And AA also told me that if there's not a God, I get to make one up. Which was another, you know, AA is really a lot, there's a lot of freedom here for me. I mean, there are so many options that I can create in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, fast forward. Is that clock the same as that clock? I guess so. Okay. Two clocks that are the same. So, I got the undergraduate degree. I got the master's degree. Kind of have thought about getting a PhD, but I don't think I wanted to finish this whole project. Got married a few times. I was laughing with my current husband that of the four marriages that I have experienced, never did I know on the morning I got married that I was going to get married that day. Never have I had... never have I had a wedding gown. Two of the four experiences were had in blue jeans. So two of them I had on a dress. I'm trying to think. Did I wear the same dress to two of them? No, I think I didn't. But the thing that what I see by that is all of that, the first marriage I was not in AA. But the other three, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And nobody said, Bonnie, you can't do that. You know, I had one sponsor for 17 years, and I've had the same sponsor since then, 17 years sober. So with marriage number, so she was around for marriage 3 and 4. And she would never tell me not to do it. She, for number 3, she said, I think it's going to get worse. She said, I don't think marrying him is going to help you. It's only going to get worse. But, you know, she never said to me, don't call me and talk to me about this. She never did. She never said, I can't deal with this. Because her wish for me is that I don't have to drink today. It's not that I make wonderful marital choices, you know. It's that I don't have to drink today. So she brought a lot of laughter to those great decisions I made. That marriage lasted 5 months. But I am currently married to someone. We've been married for, God, probably 13 years, I guess, 12 years, something like that. We were laughing today because we were trying to admit to each other that we had no plans to get married the day that we got married. So I'm not drinking. I'm having these periodic marriages. About every 10 years I got married again. And I've got these intermittent college degrees. And I keep going to AA meetings. And when I was 7 years sober, I was at work. 5 o'clock on a Monday, and I got a phone call, and I was told that my brother had killed himself. And that was the moment when I really thought that I should drink, that I might drink. That was one of my thoughts at that age. Like, well, is this how it happens? I mean, you get the call that your brother's dead, and you drink again, and. And I immediately called my sponsor, and we started talking about it. And I remember we started talking about God. You know, in the big book it says God either is or he isn't. And I think that was the question I had to ask myself. Is there God or not? I mean, my brother's dead. I can't bring him back. And in reality, the next 4 days later when I watched my brother be buried was, for me, the very worst vision of my life. And in my whole life, I can say it's before he died and after he died. I mean, it changed everything. Absolutely everything. For the next year, I just was on automatic. You know, I was just... And one of my employees the next year came to my house because I had somehow gotten all of his furniture and I'm living in like a storage space. And I mean, it was just, and she cleaned up my house enough for me to sit on my sofa for the first time in a year. And I realized that I'd really been kind of out there. I mean, I didn't drink. I didn't drug. My brother and I had talked each other out of suicide for most of our life. When he killed himself, I was baffled. I thought, "What does it do? Do I kill myself?" And when I had those thoughts, is when I finally, when I had those thoughts that way, clean and sober, is when I finally got some professional help, and I went for a year to figure out how to deal with my brother's suicide. And the next time that I had to really decide to stay sober, really, really decide to stay sober, was when I was about 17 years sober. And that's when all that stuff in the eighth step where it says, you know, there's things that happen below the level of consciousness that twist our personalities for the worst. I had, at 17 years, it was like the total bottom fell out. By this time, my son, who I had by someone I wasn't married to, my son was 5, 6 years old. And I had to really start over. You know, I had to do the steps in a totally different way. I had to look at violence that I had witnessed. I had to look at the power of, I always thought it was my father who was beating my mother. I had to realize that it was my mother lighting the friggin' match all the time. I mean, I had to see what had happened. You know, something had happened. I needed to care for the little person that I was before I picked up a drink at 10 years old. And I had to be 17 years sober to even start that process. But it was till I was 20 years sober that I met a man who knew enough about this kind of stuff to really change my life. I mean, revolutionize my life. So again, it's this time thing, you know? If somebody's got 5 years, 10 years, 2 months, I mean, if I'm not drinking today, everything is going to be okay. It is just today. That's why I am here. I don't want to drink today. And if I go to sleep tonight without alcohol and drugs, I mean, to me, it's a real miracle. I want to say one thing, and then I think I have to go. I want to talk about the laughter of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if AA was not as funny as AA is, I don't think I'd keep coming back. I mean, what I love is we don't know each other's names. You all could be making this up. Maybe my name is Lucille, you know? I mean, you don't know. You don't know. Anonymity means that I get to do anything I want, and I get to say that I'm clean and sober today. And the laughter, you know, I used to be called melancholy when I was little. And I now know that that was really, I was just a depressed human being, you know. I didn't have a place in the world. I was not okay. I needed some help. And AA said that anger can be a great motivator and that depression is anger held in. And so I've realized that if I'm depressed and it's anger, then what the hell am I going to do about it, you know? And AA said that if the tension is tough, be physical. And I realized that there's so many things. Jerry sat over here when I got sober, and she was so pretty. I don't know if you know this woman. She's 70-something years old, still sober. She is drop-dead gorgeous even now. But she was in her 40s when I met her, I think. And she would sit over there. She looked like a tennis mom, you know. I thought she's clearly not a drunk like I am. But she said that I cannot think my way into right acting. I can only act my way into right thinking. And I wrote that down on a little piece of paper. I put it on my bulletin board. And I could not remember it. I would look at it, and I would read it, and I would immediately forget it. Until I'd been sober about 6 months, and I started making my bed. And all of a sudden, it came to me. I cannot think my way into right acting. I can only act my way into right thinking. So as long as I keep coming back here, if I experience the miracle of getting here by bus or boat or bike or feet or car, if I keep coming back here, then I will experience the miracle of AA. And it's a group of drunks, you know? When you talk about the grace of God, the grace of God. If God is a group of drunks, it's by your grace that I get to come back here. No one has ever said, Bonnie, you are not welcome. You have to go away. Every time I come here, I get a smile, a laugh, and somebody says, thanks for being here. So thanks for listening.
Thank you, Bonnie. You've always been one of my favorite people.